Welcome back to the Lime Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander, and this is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts on all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's conversation is with my new friend, Humble the Poet. This conversation, I would say, is invaluable to any person that engages in any form of relationship or has a mind or a heart and would like to navigate the world with a little bit more ease. He is the author of the most recent book, How to Be Loved. He is also a rapper, a spoken word artist, and a pretty fantastic human being. He's got something like over a million subscribers, followers, whatever, across his social media channels. So people are engaged in what this dude's saying, and it's for a reason. So this conversation is really good. I think you guys are going to love it. We tap on a lot of deep stuff, and we just get to connect in a meaningful way. So I'm glad to get to share that with you guys. I want to thank you guys for sharing this conversation on across whichever social media platform you prefer. Thank you for subscribing so you get each week's episode, and thanks for doing you. I hope you guys find this supportive. Thank you for the reviews. Let's get to it with my guy, Humble the Poet. Well, I'm just going to start with, there's a bit from your book that I liked. How to Be Loved? Is that how it's called? I don't have it in front of me right now. I just listened to it. Yeah, enjoyed the audible. A quote from that, from you that I liked was, "It's the fear of self that blocks love from entering our lives."
Mm-hmm.
I thought that'd be an interesting way to open up. What does that mean to you?
You know, our fears, like our fears of being seen, our fears of being vulnerable. Motivated us to build walls, you know, previously getting hurt motivates us to build walls. And we think we have a fortress when really we have a prison. And we can't get out and nothing can get in. And that is the reason we don't realize the love that we crave. You know, to quote my therapist, she said, "I crave a depth that I sabotage by not being vulnerable."
Because you're afraid of the depth. So in listening to your book and interviews, I resonate with a lot of the things that you've experienced. And I've been going through my own process of therapy and breakups and heartbreak and, you know, wailing and crying and pushing people away and yearning and addiction and things of the sort. Mm-hmm. And I've been slowly unpacking the layers within that. And so it's such an interesting thing that you're craving this depth that you're ultimately probably at some level too ashamed or afraid to actually experience it. You push it away. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I think it's also
not you per se, but more me, but and some people, and you know.
Well, yeah, I think it's all of us to the context of like, you know, like we all want six packs, and while we eat Cheetos, you know, like it's we. I think sometimes we think it should be easier when really it's meant to be difficult. It's simple, not easy. And, you know, everything is easier said than done. Everything. And so I think oftentimes when we find struggle in it, like I want depth, but that requires trial and error. That requires being deep with some people who you can't be deep with, you know, and then having that false start, you know, it's kind of like you got to kiss your frogs till you find the prince. And it's that level of work that we don't want to kind of necessarily do. So I want depth, but I kind of want it out the box and not have to earn it. And I want someone else to initiate it, and then I can follow after I feel safe. Because oftentimes when we're vulnerable, it blew up in our face. Because again, people can only meet us to where they're at. And oftentimes when we're vulnerable, some people don't even know we're being vulnerable with them. And, you know, take it all the way back to childhood. You know, we had center of the universe mentalities because our brains were developing, and we internalized everything we went through, every experience we had, and made it about us and created coping mechanisms to deal with those. And then we never upgrade the software. We never update the policy. And then we think that stuff is protecting us when it's really not. You know, we build the fortresses as kids and never realize that they're prisons.
Hmm. Yeah, you said one of the other things you mentioned in the book is the path to love is paved in pain, or could be paved in pain. That's paraphrasing.
Yeah.
That's a funny thing, like that, like the avoidance of pain is natural. It makes sense. And then I think if you come from, there's a difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth. Some new terms I've learned recently.
Mm.
If you can operate from through a system of post-traumatic growth, which necessitates some level of you know, resourcing and maybe skill and you know, just having probably the right mentors in your life, you will look back in retrospect to all of that pain and you would never forfeit it because it was the most important thing you ever possibly could have experienced. But in the time, it's the worst possible thing and you would trade it for anything.
Absolutely.
Which is paradoxical.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we have to revisit and redefine our relationship with all that's uncomfortable. I think discomfort is literally an invitation for growth. And,
yeah,
you know, we continually kind of set it aside. And it's like, look, here's your invitation to grow. And for those who have created a deeper commitment to grow, we start searching discomfort. You know, we do crazy things like moving to New York, you know, and putting ourselves in all these chaotic scenarios voluntarily. You know, when we can live in the forest and enjoy the peace and tranquility. But it's, you know, there's a, you know, and same thing going to the gym. You voluntarily tear your muscles. You know, you voluntarily put yourself in uncomfortable situations. So when discomfort finds you, you're more prepared for it.
Yeah.
And the road, you know, the road to love is paved in pain. It's paved in, you know, as you're talking about what you're going through, like it's not, the challenges don't come from the unpleasant feelings. The challenges come from suppressing the uncomfortable feelings, you know, trying to suppress the anxiety, trying to suppress the tears, you know, let them out, you know, let them out, let them do what they do. They serve a purpose. They exist for a reason. And, you know, honor them for that. And then, you know, it's letting down those walls. It's tearing down those walls that at some point we thought we needed, which was fine. We thought we needed them. And we were trying our best with the tools we had when we built them. But let's update our policies and realize that oftentimes these walls aren't there to serve us anymore. And sure, being vulnerable makes you vulnerable to people and they can harm you because of it. But generally, that's not what's going to happen. It will happen sometimes. But generally, it's me being vulnerable with you just gives you an opportunity to be vulnerable with me. And we can actually have a meaningful connection.
Oh, yeah, I talked to Gabor Mate about this, and that was one of the things he was talking about, vulnerability. And that was one of the things he brought up was you're vulnerable whether you're open about your vulnerability or not.
Mm.
Like, you're not getting out of vulnerability.
You're not, yeah.
It's just you're either playing a game, you know, and you're like whatever your version of tough guy game is, or you're honest.
Yeah.
It's not vulnerable or not vulnerable. It's honest or dishonest with yourself.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, no, that's very, very, very true. And I mean, and he's a brilliant thinker. And I think it's, you know, we crave being, as I said, we crave being seen. We crave a depth, but deny it, you know. And, you know, hearing it's that self-sabotage kind of spirit is, you know, it makes sense that we have it. We have a, you know, a protective pessimism to ourselves because we're just afraid of getting hurt when the worst things that ever happen to us are generally in our imagination.
Yeah. That's like the, I'm going to keep on being excessively quotatious because I don't have any original ideas of my own, but there's the Marianne Williamson quote about whatever she says, you know what she says. She says, this is like, we're not afraid of our inadequacy. We're afraid of realizing that we're powerful beyond measure or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's the funny thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you play small because if you actually live up to your truth and your potential and your power and your access to fucking all the wisdom of the world and all the light and all the things, it's terrifying because I think that that's like if your honest expression of yourself, like the deepest honest expression of yourself, were to be expressed and not didn't receive the reflection of love or whatever, you know, you got up in front of a bunch of people and you gave it your all and then they booed you, that's terrifying. And so it's safer to just like never come out of the shell. But then going to Ram Dass, more unnecessary quotes, he suggests,
I mean, you're picking all the right people.
Yeah, right, exactly. He suggests you can't afford not to. So it's like, it's terrifying, but you can't afford not to.
And also, using your going on stage and getting booed, like, when's the last time we've even seen that? Right. You know, like, what we have to understand too is true hate is silence. Like, true hate is a unenthusiastic applause. Like, you're going to get applause regardless. And the only, you know, I think the only time.
A little hate feels good.
Yeah.
You get a boo, you're like, fuck yeah, that was all right. Energy, I got energy. Yeah.
When I first started and I was just doing music, I used to try to elicit boos by making fun of the city's sports teams.
Right. Right.
So I would just be like, you know, I'm from Toronto, the hockey team's the Maple Leafs. So if I'm in Edmonton, I would be like, all right, everybody, let's say go Leafs go. And it would boo. And it would be a moment of hilarity. Right. But if I put on a horrible show, I think they would just be quiet and stare at me. You know, more so than anything else. And that is a challenge, but that's also, you know, as comedians say, you can't avoid bombing. You know, like, it has to happen, and it's such a educating process from it. You know, it's a feedback loop that we have to benefit from. And it's like, and they're gifts in themselves, as you said. You look back at it and you're like, oh, I'm so grateful it happened, but I don't want it to happen again. I don't want to feel the feeling that it happened again. And you know, I'm voluntarily in that process as well right now. I think, you know, oftentimes it's discomfort that finds us, and there's discomfort that we find. And it's been a really interesting thing to be like, all right, I'm here to experience this and observe it, and I choose to be here. So I'm not absorbing it, I'm just experiencing it, you know. And it can be, you know, as you said, like, we can limit our potential, we can limit what our capabilities are by playing small and thinking small, but nobody including ourselves benefit from that. And even in the world of love, like, you know, to go with the quote, like Michael Singer saying, you know, don't limit love to your heart. You know, they're deep, you know, it can get so much deeper. It's not, love isn't just what your heart likes. And it's the challenge he says is, stop focusing on what you don't like, focus on letting go of what you do like. Mm-hmm. You know, your preferences are a cage, your biases are a cage. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, more quotes, but you know, like in Sikhi, the idea is, you know, the saint is unimpacted by slander or praise. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and so it's kind of like, we're all on social media, you can't just ignore the hate comments and enjoy the nice stuff people say. It all has to be white noise for you to elevate beyond it.
Yeah, as long as you're in that place of being at the whim of the periphery, you're still lacking anchorage within yourself.
Exactly.
And we live in a world where we really can outsource most of our validation and self-worth to the periphery, and you will always, or one will always feel a yearning from that orientation. And it's like,
it's fast food.
And there's a starving boy or girl underneath that.
Yeah. You know, there's no nutrition. There's no nutrition there.
Yeah. We're eating the menu instead of the meal.
Yeah, like I'm drinking a sparkling water right now, and a friend pointed out, he goes, you know, do you ever notice drinking sparkling water that your throat feels drier after? And I was like, does this dehydrate you? He's like, no, because I think they just make your throat dry as you drink more. And it's like, you know, it's an interesting kind of concept where it's like, okay, well, it's still a step up from drinking a soda. But it's like, it's the same thing with this validation. Validation is fast food. Like, it is so delicious. It's not nutritious. It's easy. It's cheap. And it's quick. And you get it versus the nutrition of self-respect.
Yeah.
Which is a much longer journey, a much more difficult journey, and a much more expensive journey.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to prioritize, you know, on this journey of self-love, is that to prioritize our self-respect over our self-esteem.
I wonder, from your experience, I always pronounce it seek, but that's not correct. It's pronounced sick. Is that correct? So
it's pronounced sick. However, okay. I've read diaries of travelers as early as like the 1700s, and they were writing Sikh. So I don't think it's something to you know, split hairs over.
Yeah.
But it's Sikh.
I know that you're, for if you're like a traditional Sikh person, you carry a sword. So I don't want to disrespect.
Yeah, having a dagger. Yeah. But as I said, like, if they've been saying Sikh for 300-400 years now, Sikh's cool too. But yeah, Sikh. Sikh means student.
Right.
So in Punjabi right now, to say, yeah. So, and a guru is, guru means dark, guru means light. So to be a Gur Sikh is to be a student, to go from dark to light.
Yeah. So your parents are from Punjab. Is that
Punjab,
correct?
Punjab, yeah.
Which is the where Sikhism, if that's what it's called, originated.
What would say Sikhi? Because ism would be a Western word, right?
So that originated only, from my understanding, in like the 16th century. It's like 500 years ago.
Yeah, so the first guru was born Nanak. Guru Nanak Dev Ji was born in the late 1400s. So we can start saying from the 1500s onwards. By the time he became an adult and started putting out these ideas.
Yeah. What a rich philosophy. Do we call it a religion? Is that what we call it?
I wouldn't. I think it, you know, in the world of categories, people would. I would call it a way of life. I would call it a philosophy.
I think
there's a lot of good evidence to actually view it as a potential religion, a liberator from religion.
That was what Nanak said, right? That we're not Hindu or Muslim.
Nako Hindu, Nako Muslim. Yeah, there's no, and yeah, he's like, there is no Muslim or Hindu. There's
except all humans as equals.
Yeah, so I think the second part might have been a little bit misconstrued, but I think what he was trying to say is, you know, your relationship with the divine doesn't exist through ritual and practice, and it doesn't exist through labels. And the world he was speaking to was a Hindu population that was ruled by Muslim rulers. So those are the two prominent faiths in the area. And I think what he was trying to say is, like, these labels are irrelevant. These practices are irrelevant. You know, the supreme is the supreme, and it's beyond that. And it's beyond ritual. It's beyond separation. It's ultimate love and it's sacrifice. You know, I think interestingly enough, over time, it kind of, you know, Sikhi got packaged in, and instead of liberating people from the first two, it kind of turned into a third, which I think is an interesting social experiment in itself. Especially after the British came to India and did a number on this area.
Yeah, the thing that I read was, accept all humans as your equals and let them be your only sect.
So as somebody who tries not to, you know, somebody who tries to always give things context, you know, I remember my English teacher, when she was teaching us Shakespeare, she would say, hey, when you read this play, always remember, to that audience, ghosts were as real as hamburgers. And I think that was like kind of my first, you know, teenage successful explanation of context. Like, think how they were thinking. So in that time, there was a really strong caste system. There was a sect system. So even amongst the religions, there was a hierarchy and all of that. So, you know, so it's kind of all humans are equal is really because that there was such a designation there. Yeah. And it was that more so than even a universal kind of declaration, which I think is important, because the one thing that people in Sikh philosophy do practice is being and participating in the world. Like, we're not monks who take ourselves out of it. So that's a political statement just as much as a spiritual statement. And he actually went to jail for it. They locked him up.
I'll take a moment and share about the value of foot strength and the way you can increase that with minimalist footwear. There is a study that I'm reading right now from PubMed that suggests that just after 6 months of using minimalist footwear, it increased subjects' foot strength by 57.4%. Why this is valuable is because your feet are an incredibly complex, adaptable complex of joints. There are 26 bones. There are 33 different joints. They share nerve innervations with the lower back. So if you're experiencing low back pain, that also could be a foot related issue. It is absolutely insane to be stuffing our feet into narrow toe box shoes that lack flexibility to allow our phalanges the full functional range of motion that they deserve. My favorite company for minimalist footwear is Vivo Barefoot. They are the sponsor for today. You can get yourself 15% off by going to vivobarefoot.com/align. With this link for our listeners only, you will not only get 15% off, but you will also get a 100% free trial. So if you do not love your shoes, if they do not improve your athleticism, if they do not improve foot strength, they do not feel amazing, you don't think they look amazing, then get your money back. No questions asked. That is vivobarefoot.com/align, VivoBarefoot.com/line for 15% off and a 100-day free trial on your Vivo Barefoot minimalist shoes.
Yeah, I was reading all about Sikhism or Sikhi. How am I supposed to say it?
Sikhi.
Yeah. Last night, because I'm just generally interested in like philosophy and religion and stuff, and was excited to get to talk to you about it. And one of the things that stood out that was interesting is, you know, the concept of Maya, which is, you know, commonly thrown around like the New Age world, but it's like the, you know, we're like in this dream.
Yeah.
You know, and I was reading last night that kind of like the main kind of culprits within the Maya is, I have them written down here. What are they written down? It's like
Kam, Krodh, Lobh, Ahankar.
Yeah. Where are they? It was like lust. Here they are. Lust, anger, greed, attachment, pride. Yeah. And I think it's interesting that they call them the five thieves. I think it's interesting that we in this present world, I think we assume that we're more inundated with more Maya than ever before. But this Maya thing is, people have been talking about it for, you know, hundreds of years and thousands of years.
Yeah.
Like, how different do you think we are now compared to, you know, Nanak's time as far as like the internal human experience?
I mean, I feel like, you know, it's so interesting because when we talk about Maya and the different definitions of it, I remember when I was younger, when I was working as a teacher, I was living at home, so I didn't have any bills. So, you know, what do? You don't save, you just waste all your money. And I bought myself a really nice expensive car as a teacher.
Solid
investment. And then my license plate was all Maya. And, you know, it was kind of like a play on it, being like, I know this is just an empty material possession, but at the same time. And then also, like, even the origins of humble came from that. As you recognize the five thieves, the biggest thief being ego. So humble was a reaction to that. But I think what Guru Nanak Dev Ji did very successfully and very accurately was recognize that it's not the external, it's the internal.
Yeah.
You know, we have levels externally, you know, like, you can be what people say, you know, you're plugged into the matrix. I think the matrix was a really good analogy to explain Sikh philosophy as well, is that you're plugged into it, but there's levels, like, and there's layers to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start to realize, you know, another good quote, true freedom exists in discipline, because you are also a slave to your habits, desires, and emotions. You know, so now when people think about, you know, concepts of slavery, they think about, you know, physical oppression and all that, which are, but it's continual levels. And I think when Guru Nanak Dev Ji mentions Maya, a big mindset, a big idea in Sikhi is, you know, everything in relation to your mind, right? Mm-hmm. So Maya, your mind is what exists in the delusions or that dream. So, you know, yeah, you can be like, yeah, I'm in the red light district of Amsterdam. I'm knee deep in the Maya, right? But it's also like, no, I'm also, you know, I had to wait, you know, 3 minutes for Aaron, and now I'm telling myself a story that he doesn't respect me. That's also Maya, you know, there's that. So, and the beauty of it is, you know, I view Maya as the mud, and, you know, lotus is only growing the mud. So, you know, so when they refer to those things, they don't refer to, you know, and I appreciate you calling them the thieves. Oftentimes it's kind of been reconstrued into the sins, the five sins, and they're not sins, they're thieves. It's those five, your ego, your anger, your attachment, your lust, and your greed are the five things that rob you of your peace.
Yeah.
That will always rob you of your peace you know, in the 3D world and in any world, other world that you participate in are aware of. And all the antidotes and the ways to address those are going to be internal, you know. And do I think it's interesting that we are probably in the peak level of dopamine addiction, and I don't even know if they could feed us anymore? Probably not. So it's probably an additional layer of Maya, you know. It's just, and there is endless dopamine, you know, being shoved down our throats and distracting us. And the commercialization of convenience, I think, is definitely, you know, killing our resilience and making it even more difficult. And you can imagine, you know, how much peace were people who like lived on farms, you know, well, how much peace did they require? You know, like what was happening that gave them anxiety? And, you know, if they needed this kind of internal peace. So I think we've probably added more layers of Maya, you know, yeah, in this world. But, you know, that's actually, you know, a very regular conversation I have with Jay Shetty, which is, you know, the concept of existing in the Maya, you know, and it's viewing yourself as the lotus, being like, the goal here isn't to remove myself from the Maya. The goal is to understand I'm in the Maya and creating from it, just like a lotus can only grow in the mud. And, that I think is a really important idea versus kind of a lot of Western ideas, which is this is right, this is wrong. Yep. And if you do more stuff that is right, we're good. If you do more stuff that's wrong, you're going to get punished. And also that starts to degenerate into this looks right and this looks wrong. And I've seen that in my culture as well, where it's like, okay, if you look the part, then people will believe that you are the part. And it's like, you can't, that's not how it works. This all exists within us. So, you know, especially when people think of Sikhi, they think turbans and beards. It's like, no, it's what you just said, the five thieves. The entire philosophy of Sikhi is about those five thieves. It's about understanding these are the five things that will take you away from your peace. It's not about sins. It's not about heaven or hell. It's about every time you feel a lack of peace, it's probably due to one of these thieves. And most of the decisions and pleasure chasing that you're doing is to medicate that lack of peace. You're not chasing pleasure to feel good. You're chasing pleasure to feel less bad. And just to recognize that and build that awareness and have grace for yourself, because it's okay that you do that. Like, you don't suck because you do that. You're human. This is, you know, this is what the world is. And all we can do is hold grace for ourselves and focus on progress and being like, okay, my heart broke, so I turned to the bottle today. That's what I know. But now I know there's alternatives, like breathing or journaling or something. So I'm going to try something else. But also, I'm not going to beat myself up if I fall back into the bottle, because that's a product designed to keep me hooked, just like my phone. You know, just like most things are designed with intention to keep you hooked. And then you're told something's wrong with you when you're hooked. You know, I'm currently staying with a friend, and right outside his place, there's a guy with a little French fry stand. He only sells French fries and popcorn chicken. And I'm walking by every day fighting the good fight. But, you know, I know. But just proximity, just knowing he's outside, I hear him calling me, right? Like, you know what I mean? Proximity just makes a difference. We're human, you know, and I'm going to give in and I'm going to give myself grace. Like, that's nothing wrong with me for giving in. If every time I step out of the apartment, I see this guy in his French fries. And I'm like, this is why they spend millions of dollars naming stadiums. This is why they spend so much money on ads at the Super Bowl. Like, they know what they're doing, and we need to hold grace for ourselves, because there we are being programmed by all of this stuff. Intentionally and unintentionally.
Yeah, having compassion and also probably having compassion for like the they and the them, you know, and I think it could be easy to place ourselves as an individual into like a victimized role of like, okay, mm-hmm. well, the you know, the cards are stacked against me and like they are the bad guy. It's like, I think generally if we cultivate compassion in any direction, it goes in every direction. You could start with yourself. You could start with somebody else, you know, whatever. But just like compassion, it's like this fractal engine that just it goes out in all directions.
That's such a beautiful way to describe it. That's a quote that I'm going to use in another podcast
now. Yeah, that's for you. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Compassion in any direction is compassion in every direction.
Yeah, I think that's good. That was my only original quote of this podcast. We'll stop there. I'll start leading everybody else.
It's a banger. I was gonna be like, as the kids say, but I'm sure the kids don't say that. But it's a banger.
Yeah. But the other thing I was thinking as you were talking was the labeling things is incredibly important. And you can see that even like measuring brain waves. You can see if a person is afraid, you can see response in their amygdala and cortisol and norepinephrine, all things will happen. Mm. You can actually see downregulation of the amygdala, which is kind of like one of the fear centers of the brain, just through the process of labeling the fear.
Mm.
So if you're in that place where you're like, you know, in reference to what we're talking about, it's like, oh, wow, this is all a freaking illusion. This is a dream. This is Maya. Mm. Like, okay, cool. Mm. You know, and going back, if you go back to the 30s or whenever it was that Edward Bernays and he was like the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He's known the father of modern psychology or marketing.
Marketing, yeah.
They transitioned things to being like, okay, it's products. It's not about how good a product is. It's about what the people don't have, you know, and how this is going to be actually like an emotional representation of who they desire to be. Mm. And if you can place them into a point of actual like self, like a lack of self-actualization or like a deficit within self. Mm. And once they get this product, they're going to have confidence and they're going to have the girl that they always wanted. And they're going to have all the dreams and the desire. They'll have the Maya.
Yeah.
You know, like, and then now that's how we orient sales and advertising. And then you just look around the world, like we're bombarded by that all day since we're a baby.
Yeah.
So it's like having compassion for ourselves within that is valuable, and also then extending compassion out for the advertisers and the man or the them and all of that is probably valuable too.
Yeah, because I think it's also like we as human beings have forever been programmed to keep the tribe happy. Mm-hmm. Play your part in the tribe, because if you don't, they'll kick you out and you'll die. And rejection feels like death because of that. I think the problem now is our tribe is society, which is a faceless community.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah, and the tribe's goal was to thrive, grow, and survive. Society's is to thrive, grow, and survive, but they do it through this engine called an economy, right? Which is buy shit, be happy. And everything is designed around that in mind. So it's like, you know, we need to entertain you so we can sell you products in between for 30 seconds. But now we didn't realize that the way we entertain you was also informing you on things. So now it's like we watch a romantic comedy that's there to distract us so they can sell us products, but also it's informing on what our desires, and it's informing us what we think love needs to be. You know, when the truth is, the people that we should aspire to be like, or in the relationships we should aspire to have, are ones of peace. But that would not be entertaining television to watch. You know, that's like watching the Fireplace Channel. Like it's right. Beautiful.
I love that channel.
Yeah, that's but legit. It's not going to fire
most,
off
you. Most hours played on my TV is the Fireplace Channel,
as it should be. But again, you're intentionally and you're prioritizing peace, right? And as I said, like that's. You know, you're literally the last chapter of the book. I go, all I'm doing is telling you the difference. All I'm doing is telling you the difference between broccoli and French fries while I'm eating broccoli and French fries. You know, that's all this is. It's like there is something delicious and addictive in the salty French fries, and there's a nutrition and peace in eating broccoli. But, you know, you can't, when you put them side by side, it's not going to always be a fair fight. And it's like, we are humans and we are, you know, our biology is not catching up as fast as the technology that we're being exposed to. Like we're not even our eyes aren't even primed for like these modern colors. Like the McDonald's arches are that color for a reason, you know, because these are colors not found in nature, you know, so they pop up and then they really, you know, have an impact on us. So I think the grace part is important instead of people just beating themselves up for like why they're doing things wrong. And I think that was a very intentional purpose in the book, was to, when I pointed something out, I would point it out with grace and I would point it out within myself, you know, it wasn't like, it was like what I do. Like I have a whole, you know, I have a whole introduction about my addiction to approval. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an approval addict, and I wanted, you know, I wanted people to understand I'm in the same boat as everybody else. I love approval. I love admiration. I love worship. I love attention. I love all the things that everybody else loves. And I understand all the tools that we have in this world now, like social media, are making, are pulling on that addiction even more. And that's going to make it difficult, you know? So when I feel anxiety, instead of doing 30 intentional breaths like we just did, and, you know, feeling amazing for this entire conversation, I would just pull out my phone or pull out some other dopamine fix. And that wasn't there to feel good. That was there to feel less bad.
Yeah, I feel, it feels like you need, it's it, those energies, you know, or like personality characteristics, they're almost like parasitic patterns that at some point served a function. They were adaptive patterns, and then they hung on to the host being, you know, us, higher self us. And now we have these kind of parasitic patterns that were adaptive at one point when we were 2 or 6 or 17 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now they're hanging on, draining us every day. And so I'd be curious your perception of how does one start to release the parasites, like truly, or to, is the path starving the parasite? Is the path working with the terrain, being like the host, being yourself, your emotions, your conscious, your spirit, like internal landscape, to make the parasite not be, the landscape not be hospitable for the parasite any longer? Is parasite a fair analogy? Do you have any perspective on any of that?
I mean, I love the analogy. I think the interesting thing is, you know, you can make an argument that the species that we are, being the only species outside of the circle of ecosystem that this earth has created, could be viewed as a parasite in itself, you know. And
I think it's a dangerous perspective, but yeah.
You know, we spread, we take, we don't give, you know, versus a whale or versus, mm-hmm. you know, a penguin. And somehow we got out of that circle, you know, and we saw that happen very slowly, because even some Homo sapien cultures were trying their best to be one with the earth and nature and stuff like that. But we're not there anymore. And as George Carlin, you know, famously jokes, maybe Mother Nature made humans just to make plastic, you know, yeah, maybe like Mother Nature loves plastic, yeah, and we're just here for that. But I think, you know, I look at it going back to the concept of the paradox, where it's like, maybe the, you know, the parasite or the challenging parts or the five thieves, you know, will always exist within us. And I think step one really is the awareness, you know, the awareness and the grace. And then I think after that is really going to be the practice. You know, it's going to be this acknowledgement of like, okay, I am currently, when I feel anxiety, I try to medicate it. And my number one way to medicate my anxiety is looking at my phone. Okay, so why is that? Okay, what it really is, my anxiety is a dopamine withdrawal. I'm going through withdrawal of dopamine. I'm addicted to dopamine. So I need a hit. I need a hit by scrolling through my phone. Okay, so the first thing I need to do is I need to acknowledge that I'm addicted to dopamine. And how do you get off any addiction? Okay, we'll try cold turkey. Well, cold turkey is going to be a journey. And, you know, to go from a bad place to a better place, you got to go through a worse place. That's what I got to try. Now, what can I pack on that journey? You know, maybe some breath work, you know, maybe a lot of push-ups, maybe a whole bunch of other different things, or maybe something that's a little bit, maybe little drops, microdoses of dopamine that aren't as impactful, that aren't on my phone. Who knows? But I think it's building the awareness and not judging yourself for it. Because as I said, like, this stuff's been here. And again, I'm not, and I can't speak for you, but I haven't found somebody who's like on this earth who is completely void of any of these parasites or these thieves. So I'd rather, you know, I love what Aubrey Marcus said, and it actually, the first, you know, the beginning of this conversation after the breath work, you made me think of it. You know, judge your spiritual teacher by how loud they laugh.
Oh, yeah, you know, sure.
Just heard you laughing really loud. I'm like, you know, this is a good guy right here. Like, he you know, that's a good laugh. And, you know, versus like, oh, I have no lust. Oh, I have no attachment. Right. Oh, no, it's like, yo, I'm a guy who's trying his best. Yeah. And I can still laugh at life. And I think, so I don't, I would, you know, my, you know, my book, How to Be Loved, is not about how to make everybody fall in love with you and realize all the love in the world. It's about recognizing mostly what isn't love that we think is love. Like, what are these facsimiles? What are these fake things? And I think when it comes to these parasites, it's the same way. Where it's like, okay, well, what's my relationship with these things? They're here. Yeah. They're in my house. These are, you know, someone said to me yesterday, victimhood is my roommate. And I like that idea of like, okay, well, I'm living with victimhood. Now, how often am I engaging in it? Why would I like feeling like a victim? Well, self-pity is fast food connection. The second I feel sorry for myself, I feel connected. No one knows what it feels like to be me. You know, so it's easier.
You feel special. It's like an elite position, especially now. Like now there's like an elitism around victimhood. It's like a badge.
1,000%.
Which is the most, like I borrowed this from somebody else. I don't know who, I think it's Jordan Peterson or something, but like the most dangerous tyrant is a tyrant that identifies as a victim. That's like, oh shit, this is a problem.
And I can't name a politician who isn't trying to make all their voters feel like victims. Like, it's weaponized against us for that.
Yeah.
And it's challenging because there are real life inequities and, you know, inequalities happening on this earth and oppression. And I think it's really about recognizing, asking yourself the questions. Well, but where's the empowerment in recognizing my victimhood, you know? And the empowerment exists in the responsibility. The empowerment doesn't exist in pointing out the victimhood. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book says, you know, self-love is being your own nurturing parent. And the spirit of that chapter is saying, yes, your parents messed you up, but there is nothing effective about going back to them and telling them they messed you up. You need to go deeper and say, well, what were the gaps in my upbringing? And as an adult, how can I fill those gaps? You know, I have a friend who grew up, you know, he grew up on the streets. He had a mother with who suffered from addiction. And, you know, he got himself off the streets and he's living a good life. And he just took his inner child on a shopping spree to the dollar store, you know, and they bought candy and they bought toys and they bought all the things that, because he probably wished when he was a kid, when he was homeless, seeing the dollar store, seeing all the little toys in there and whatever. And he took his inner child on a shopping spree, 20 bucks, chocolate bars and Cheetos. And he goes, it prompted a conversation for hours with his inner child. And hearing questions from his inner child about who he was now and the habits that he still kept and the coping mechanisms that he kept. Like, are we safe? Do we still have to keep our head on a swivel? Why do we walk so fast? And him realizing like, oh, a lot of this is just old software that doesn't serve me anymore. So I think awareness and practice, you know, are really important. And practice, you know, movement, journaling, vulnerability, you know, I think these things are extremely important. And I would never, you know, this isn't an infomercial, so I would never promise someone that they can get rid of all of it. You know, I would not say like in 12 easy steps, we'll get rid of all the parasites. You know, I think it's the moment you realize your relationship with them, their impact, as you said, just identifying the fear reduces its impact. You know, I think it goes back to the cliche, hope for the best, prepare for the worst, even talking it all out.
I want to take a moment and share the morning ritual that I've stuck with for the last year. That is crawling out of bed, walking to the kitchen, and pouring myself a glass of AG1. I learned about this originally from Dr. Andrew Huberman. He's been drinking this stuff for the last decade or so, and I am also a massive fan of the product. Why I like it is it blends several different supplements that I would take anyway. So it is a probiotic and prebiotic, as well as a multivitamin and also a mineral supplement. It is the highest sourced ingredients. It tastes absolutely delicious. I notice a measurable change in my energy and my mood, and it is a gratifying sensation to know that I'm starting the day by covering my micronutrient baselines. So if you want to take ownership of your health, today is a great time to start. Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D, as well as 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. To get this, all you got to do is go to athleticgreens.com/align. That's athleticgreens.com/align. I'm incredibly confident you guys are going to love this stuff. Go check it out, athleticgreens.com/align.
like to take a moment and share about a supplement that has changed the game in the way that I sleep. That is supplementing with magnesium. Magnesium is one of those things that it's just wise to supplement with because it's deficient in our soil. So 75% of Americans are deficient in magnesium. Magnesium is imperative for muscular recovery, rest, relaxation. It's also supportive for bone density, digestion, a lot of things. It's a big deal. And Mag Breakthrough from Bioptimizers is my go-to. It's been my go-to for years. I really love the stuff. It contains all 7 different forms of magnesium. They have 100% money-back guarantee. If you do not feel more relaxed, if you do not feel like you're improving your muscular recovery, then they don't want your money, and they have 100% money-back guarantee. So if you want to improve the quality of your sleep like I have done with Mag Breakthrough, then you can go over to magbreakthrough.com/alignpodcast. You can use the code ALIGN10 for a 10% discount. That's magbreakthrough.com/alignpodcast, and then use align10 for 10% discount.
It's just an issue of bandwidth, you know. Yes. So if you go from having a bunch of junk food in your cupboard and fridge to suddenly clearing it all out, and that's your solution, you're going to fucking starve, and you're going to be hungrier than ever before, and you're going to binge back even harder.
Mm.
So that's when community comes in. That's when accountability comes in. That's when nature comes in. That's when having, you know, discipline. Maybe you don't have discipline with yourself, and you have that authenticity and honesty with yourself. You say, I need accountability. I need a support group. I need someone to check up on me because I need to get through this rough patch. That's like, people are social creatures. And if you look at culture, historically, forever, we've either been in small bands of tribes, you know, or teepees, where your teepee doesn't have a lock on it, and you go from place to place, to being in like European towns where there's a town center, and every night you walk to the town center and you hang out and you drink beer and you dance, and you know, like that's like what, that's what human is. Like cooperation is what makes humans so special. Yes. Cooperation with each other. Yeah. And now, if you look around the world, we're much more in these like nuclear kind of sects. They're like this separate, you know, I live alone in an apartment. That's very normal. You know, it sounds like you do or will or whatever. Mm. You know, and that's like the standard normal thing. And I think that then we sit in our apartments or houses or whatever, and we look on social media, and we see, this isn't new information. We look at other people's highlight reels, and we assume that other people are living this illustrious, amazing, social, loving, connected life. And then we have comparison, and then comparison's the thief of joy. Mm-hmm. We go to the spiral. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, okay, it's not just take away. It's not just starve the parasite. It's like, how do we fill back? You know, and that's, I think some people are kind of like shaking their head, like, I don't fucking know how to fall back. We're supposed to put
and, this. And it has to be intentional, because I mean, you know, obviously it's like the invention of the ship was the invention of the shipwreck. And it's like, you know, it's in Sikhi, we have that concept, Sangat. Sangat is the community, right? Yeah, it's satsang. Yeah. And you know, the company you keep, or you're a product of the 5 people that you're around. Yeah. So it's like, it's that level of intentionality, I think, is really important, you know, to it. And I think, you know, one of the motivations for my move from Los Angeles to here was more community, and more even just the idea of being outside around human beings, because I was in a little bit of an isolated area where I was staying in the valley. And I think a lot of that will kind of make us a lot more analog, which I think is a good first step as well. You know, getting back into the analog world more so than a lot of the other things that are happening on social media. And you're absolutely right to start. We compare our behind the scenes to other people's highlight reels, and we forget that, you know, even though we know we're lying on social media, we forget that they're lying too. And I'm fortunate because I have DMs full of people asking me for help who look super happy in their pictures.
Sure.
You know, they're telling me that they're in the darkest places of their life, and you look at their pictures and they look like they're having a jolly old time.
I get that too.
Yeah, so you see that disconnect. And I think that's an important thing to kind of recognize. And it goes back to, you know, my whole thing is, if I had to shove down a religion down everybody's throat, it would be the religion of self-awareness, picking up on your patterns, being aware of yourself, paying attention to yourself, asking yourself why constantly, you know, just like give yourself 15 whys a day and just go down that rabbit hole and see where it takes you. Yeah. Cause I think, as I said, I don't know. I look at it as, You know, I like that Peter Krohn idea that our software is like built in and it served its purpose. And like, you can't delete the calculator app on your iPhone. It's built in, you know? So I feel like our paranoia, our need to be accepted, some of these things that have now been weaponized against us, they're here to stay. And now we view them as negative things, but really, you know, I think you hit it on the head, man. Edward Bernays, who, you know, he literally said people, what did he say? He goes, people can be manipulated, so they should. And, you know,
Jesus.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, him convincing women to smoke cigarettes and making it a social issue because he's
freedom sticks
or, you know, all the ingenious things that he was able to accomplish. But you're like, that changed the course of where we went with all of this. And now, you know, we have billion-dollar companies that have hired all the Edward Bernays of the world. And like, how do we keep people just thumbing on our screens? How do we keep people lining up for our devices? How do we keep people? It's just like this is a massive, massive endeavor and machine and engine. And it's so big that even if it's crashing, it's going to happen so slowly over time. It's like the boiling frog, you know, like they don't know. And I think that's why this has to be internal. So when I go back to, you know, and there's also, and I think there's like John Green in his Crash Course series on YouTube pointing out that there's like articles from like 1915 where they're saying the pace of life is too fast and it's overwhelming.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, there was fear of starting to read books back in the, like when the origination of books, because we wouldn't remember information anymore. Or like writing, or like there's always, so that's the, I mean, that's the thing, is just because something is changing doesn't mean it's bad, and there will be resistance. It's just, I think like what you're saying, if you have that anchoring and support and you know, fulfillment and connection within, then you're free to, you know, you can go do really anything and you're not going to be susceptible to the traps. But if you're not, then you're susceptible to all the traps. No matter if we got calculators, books, or porno, like,
and just recognizing, as I said, recognizing what they are. I have a friend who's now 6 years sober from alcohol. I think 7 years sober from pornography, and you know, he never refers to them as vices. You know, he almost reestablished a relationship with them or redefined the relationship with them as pretty much allergies.
Yeah, it's like an AA perspective. You have a spiritual malady and you're like allergic to these.
Yeah, you're allergic. Yeah. And I think, you know, and then there's a grace there because he'll drink like non-alcoholic beer or whatever. But like there's, you know, but he exists at such peace. Like he never got on the smartphones because that's what his darkest time was during that period. Right. So, you know, he had some side scroll BlackBerry. You know, by the time he sobered up, and you know, it was a conscious decision not to get on. And watching somebody who didn't get plugged into this, like nothing he does is for display purposes. None of his decisions are about capturing the photo. Nothing he takes a photo of is he thinking about a caption. Like it's very interesting, and he does live a life of peace. And he's not in any capacity, like he's not reading books on spirituality. I don't even think he meditates. He works out at a jungle gym outside his apartment in the morning, you know, with like hockey gloves, and I was in Los Angeles, you know, last week, and he called me and he was like heavy panting. I was like, you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm just jogging. It's 5:45 here. Just figured I jog and talk to you at the same time. I'm like, and he's in Berlin. So it's like, you're just in a place that doesn't, you know, never has sunshine and it's cold and you're just jogging and having a conversation with me. It was just, but he operates on that, but he got lucky that he never got into a lot of the things. Like he didn't, but I mean, again, I've never had the challenges that he had in those other departments. So just thinking about it out loud, I think it is just recognizing, because I think a lot of times people don't. Like, I think some, like, being Canadian, coming here, learning about retail therapy, like, it's, you know, the sweetest people think a new pair of shoes will cure it all. And I'm like, if the new pair of shoes cured it all, why'd you buy another pair of shoes 2 weeks later? Like, it's Band-Aid solutions. And I think just that awareness starting, being like, look, these are literally Band-Aid solutions. And that's okay, but there are other alternatives. And one of the alternatives is breathing, like literally breathing with intention way deeper. Mm. You know, Wim, I was super fortunate to train with Wim in Poland. And he just kept saying, breathe, motherfucker, breathe. Like, that's all I kept saying. He's like, that's it. And you're like, you can't even package this and sell it. You just breathe.
And you know? And Wim, you know, still and has, and, you know, probably will continue to, like we all do, like has his own versions of demons. And there's like, it's very easy to pedestalize someone such as a Wim or such as a, you know, whatever, any of the people that you mentioned. And then you get to actually connect with them in a meaningful way. And you're like, oh, okay, you are, it's the same thing you're saying. Like, you're just a dude.
What I appreciate, because growing up in the South Asian culture, there's a lot of these fake gurus, right? Yeah. And then you meet, and then, as I said, like, that's why I love Aubrey's definition, judge them by how loud they laugh.
Yeah.
Right. So these fake gurus don't laugh. They take themselves too seriously. And then a guy like Wim, like the first night, he's like, hey, what are you guys doing? What time do you guys want to wake up? He's like, we're like 10 a.m. All right, I'll see you guys at 11 a.m. And also, if you guys want to drink, I'll teach you how to breathe out a hangover. And I'm sitting there like, yeah, I'm not pedestaling this guy. He's you know, he reminds me of a mall Santa. Like, he's freaking hilarious, you know? And he is a guy that went through some real shit.
Yeah.
And really then was shit. Going through so much pain that he sat in ice to try to make it go away. He didn't sit in ice to do some meditation. He sat in ice because he was in so much pain. The same way he was a broken person that sat in ice. And I think there's just a beauty to that. And I do love the idea of these regular guys figuring this stuff out. And none of it being revolutionary.
Well, like, that's
the revolutionary,
that's every guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's every guy. I don't know. Literally, like that. I wonder about like some of the gurus of the world. Is there such a thing as some reincarnated, you know, bodhisattva spirit? I mean, I think we're all spirit. I think we're all gods and goddesses and, you know, entities. And like, there's a lot more going on here than what meets the eye is my perception. But someone that, yeah, what is a guru? What is someone that's not just a dude that does hard stuff and has kind of worked on his own, you know, essentially?
That's why I love, you know, the definition of guru being from dark to light. So now if I said, hey man, like, you know, we're recording on Zencast right now. And I'm like, hey man, like, can you show me how to use this? You're my guru, you know, for that.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I look at it. So a guru is anyone that takes you from dark to light. Right. And at the same, you know, as to say, like, in Sikhi, we don't have worship, right? Like, we don't have rituals and worship. We don't have hierarchies. We don't have high priests. We don't have any of that. We don't view someone as better than the other. And, you know, even though there was 10 gurus, we viewed them as 10 candles with the same flame. And then they put all their writing in the Guru Granth Sahib. Granth means compilation. And which is interesting because and this is a Jordan Peterson idea of the success of the Bible being one of the most collaborated documents in the world could be attributed to why it's so successful. So because it's a collaborative document.
Right.
And one of his ideas is the wisdom exists in all of us, whether we know it or not. And the wisdom can come out of us, whether we know it or not. So he kind of alluded to the idea that, like, even all the beauty that's in the Bible, you don't even give credit to the individual writers. It just, as a force of nature, was created just through its sheer level of compilation and natural kind of movement. And I like that idea a lot. You know, I like that idea that we, as a collective, have, like, and you know, this is a key, you know, we are all drops in the ocean, and oceans in the drop, right? So we are the guru. We are, you know, this idea, you know, the, it's so funny because he's getting in trouble for a bunch of stuff. But the Dilbert guy, I'm forgetting his name. The guy who created Dilbert.
I don't know. Terrible pop culture.
Scott Adams. He's a really interesting. He's a futurist. I think that's the term. Like, he's really good at picking up on patterns. So he was like the first public figure to predict Trump's winning the election, like way before everybody else. And then. Since then, I think he started a podcast and got a bunch of trouble for saying some funny stuff. But he came out with a book in 2000 called God's Debris. And the big idea, the book is beautiful. And the big idea was, it's not science versus religion. They're going to join together. And his idea was, if the Big Bang was God exploding, the internet is God reforming. you know, yeah. And that's like you and I being able to have a conversation like this and, you know, a million people being able to hear it. That is God, you know, yeah. we are, and it's almost like we're turning into one giant brain, you know, and yeah. we're neural links and all of that really crazy stuff. And I think there's a beauty to that idea versus trying to discover some guy in a mountain who claims to be the reincarnation of Buddha or anything else. It's like maybe, you know, collectively all in a room, you know, when we're all cheering for our favorite sports team or something, like that's where we find God. Because
it's definitely an incarnation of it.
Yeah, because our egos melt. There's no longer, it's a sea of us. We don't know where you start and I end. You know? And I think there's a beauty to that. And you become the everything and the nothing, to me, which are all the definitions of God and love.
Yeah, and well, it's the blending of the duality and the unicity.
Yeah.
If you just got stuck in unicity, you'd be like, oh, fuck, I don't get it here. But if you're stuck in duality, you start getting paranoid and anxious. And, you know, yeah. You're jerking off too much. You're smoking crack. It's too much. Yeah. A little unicity.
No, 100%. No, you're absolutely correct. And it's like, but I think seeing it from that concept where it's just like, you know, and every human is a potential innovator. So as access to information starts to increase, more potential innovators create more dope stuff. Yeah. And here we are creating all the things that we can create. And, you know, that can be God, and it doesn't require any other type of worship or fear.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed getting to connect with you, man. I hope we get to do this in the IRL at some point. Do you have any awesome plans coming up?
It's so funny. Literally right before we got on the thing, I was on a call with a friend who was like, have you been to Austin? And I was like, I have. He's like, it is so cool. It is such a cool place. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. No, you know what? Austin was actually, that was number two on the list between Austin and New York. And we're here for you. Have some good friends out there. And
if your buddy's at Aubrey, he's one of my closest buds out here. So he'll play pickleball and do things.
Yeah, I keep hearing about this thing called pickleball. So I'm looking forward to it. It's taken over.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Thing. Yeah, we'll definitely do this in real life. And thank you for the breathing ahead of time. I think that's
good, right?
Set a whole different tone to what this interview would have been had it not been the other way.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for being here. Thanks for co-creating. I listened to the Audible version of How to Be Loved, and How to Be Loved, and then it has like the parentheses D at the end, so love/loved. Really enjoyed it, and you read it, which I always appreciate. I think that's like just is nice hearing it from the author. So people tuning in, if you want to learn more about this, I highly recommend that book. Is there any other stuff to point people to, or what's the best place for people to go from here?
I'm at Humble the Poet on all the social medias. You can find my stuff there. I might not be there, but you can find my stuff. I got someone posting my stuff as I try to keep it off my phone. But humblethepoet.com is where all the things are happening. And I mean, I just appreciate this conversation so much. Part of me forgot that I was here to plug a book.
Yeah, right. That's good. That's the preference.
No, really.
At least we did it.
No, we definitely did it. And trust me, we definitely did it. I appreciate you for helping me slow things down. It was, I think that those 30 breaths were way more needed than I realized.
Dope, man. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, we're all co-regulating together, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Like, I need you as much as you need me, and like that's it. And that vulnerability of opening up to that, that's like, oh, okay, now we can exhale a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, exactly. And then we slow down a little bit. Where are we trying to get to exactly? I don't know. Yeah.
No, you relaxed me so much. I couldn't even pretend to sound like an impressive human being, and I appreciate that. Like it was good. Yeah, it felt like whatever masks I had on, whether I was aware of them or not, a few of them melted off very quickly. And I think,
rad! I noticed that with both of us throughout it. I mean, that's we're all attuning to each other, so that's we're like we move through a thing together. That's cool.
Yeah, but no, it was good. Yeah, it was really good.
Word up, man. Well, so that is it. That's all. Grab the book, How to Be Loved, and appreciate y'all tuning in. I'll see you next week. Hope you guys.
guys enjoyed that conversation. Thank you for subscribing so you get each week's episode. Thanks for checking us out over at the YouTube channel at Align Podcast. We share two new instructional videos each week on how to move better in your body, as well as short clips from this podcast. So that is it. That is all. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for doing you. I'll see you next week.